Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Estelle. Coming up on the show today, over the past 24 hours, Barack Obama became the first ever sitting president to visit Laos, a country which still feels the legacy of US bombings. Many thousands of unexploded bombs are still buried across the country from the so-called Secret War of 1964 to 1973.
In just 3 weeks, a peace deal between Colombia and the FARC rebel forces is due to be signed in Cartagena before the Colombian people vote on its final ratification in a referendum next month. But President Santos finds himself at odds with so-called elites over support for the historic accord.
A new study in the US suggests that extremism online could be far more prevalent amongst white nationalists and self-confessed Nazi sympathisers than Muslim extremists such as Daesh.
As more opposition protests are planned for tomorrow in the Venezuelan capital, the security services are on high alert after releasing evidence that they say backs up the Maduro administration's fears of violence or an attempted coup.
Protesters gathered in London yesterday, insisting that the British government stop delaying Britain's exit from the EU and invoke Article 15 now.
The United Kingdom is now the second biggest arms dealer in the world, though campaign groups have raised questions over the appropriateness of many of the contracts given the sale of arms to countries on the UK's own human rights watch list.
And a Scottish rambler is suing Donald Trump's golf estate in northeast Scotland over a breach of privacy.
That's all coming up over the next half hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus. Having a US president in Laos would have once been unimaginable. Those were the words of President Barack Obama at a speech earlier today in the Laotian capital, Vientiane, marking a historic shift forward in the US-Laos relations. Laos's relationship with the United States has been tense, to say the least, ever since the Secret War, which ran from 1964 to 1973, which left a legacy of thousands of unexploded bombs throughout the country, huge swathes of which remain to this day.
President Obama has been on a charm offensive during this, the first visit of a sitting US president to Laos, as well as addressing the bitter legacy of the US bombings all those years ago. Here is an excerpt from his speech earlier today.
I realize that having a US president in Laos would have once been unimaginable. 6 decades ago, this country fell into civil war, and as the fighting raged next door in Vietnam, your neighbors and foreign powers, including the United States, intervened here. As a result of that conflict and its aftermath, many people fled or were driven from their homes. At the time, the U.S. government did not acknowledge America's role. It was a secret war, and for years, the American people did not know. Even now, many Americans are not fully aware of this chapter in our history, and it's important that we remember today. Over 9 years, from 1964 to 1973, the United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs here in Laos, more than we dropped on Germany and Japan combined during all of World War II. It made Laos per person the most heavily bombed country in history. As one Laotian said, the bombs fell like rain. Villages and entire valleys were obliterated. The ancient Plain of Jars was devastated. Countless civilians were killed. And that conflict was another reminder that whatever the cause, whatever our intentions, war inflicts a terrible toll, especially on innocent men, women, children.
U.S. President Barack Obama speaking earlier today in the Laos capital, Vientiane.
The US officially acknowledged its role in the secret war back in 1997, although efforts to clear the many thousands of unexploded bombs are still nowhere near completion, and huge areas in Laos are effectively minefields. Efforts to clear those unexploded bombs have been ongoing, but with poor resources, the pace is slow. President Obama announced today, however, that the US will double its annual funding to $90 million over the next 3 years to help Laos expand its work in removing the bombs, as well as increasing support for victims.
Joining me on the line now is the chair of the Legacies of War Advisory Board in America, Titus Peachey. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Mr. Peachey. As it stands, using only the resources currently at the country's disposal, how far away is Laos from clearing the land entirely of unexploded bombs?
You know, we'll never get to the point where somebody says, okay, here's the last bomb, let's destroy it. That's just not going to be possible. with the tens of millions of bombs in the ground, in forested land and in fields and villages, it will never be completely cleared. But with resources currently in hand, I'd say we're still several decades away. We've made significant progress, particularly in the last several years. The casualty rates have come down considerably. It used to be over 300 a year. And the last two or three years, it's been well under 50 casualties per year. And I think there's probably some undercounting going on, but clearly the numbers have come down due to the clearance and also the risk education that's going on.
Obviously, it's a positive that the numbers of people dying each year seems to be coming down, but obviously 50 a year is still a very high number by any other country's standards. Why has it taken the U.S. so long to address this situation?
Well, you know, in the aftermath of the war, relationships between Laos and the U.S. were very strained, very difficult politically. Unlike in Vietnam and Cambodia, where the U.S. Cut off all diplomatic relationships, they always maintained a small U.S. embassy staff in Laos, so there was a relationship there. But relationships were very difficult. I worked there in the early 80s, and it still politically was a fairly difficult time in terms of being able to build trust between the two governments. The other issue is that for a long time, we really didn't know how big the problem was. There was no release of records in terms of bombing strike data. We knew the problem was bad, but we didn't know what the scale was. And the release of records didn't happen until around the year 2000. And, during those early years, there just was a very low level of commitment on the part of the U.S. and other donors as well. The actual clearance project started in 1994, and that was by a small private group in the United States that I was part of called Mennonite Central Committee. And we worked together with MAG, the Mines Advisory Group from the UK, to begin the project along with the Lao government. And it was after that initial project got on the ground that governments got involved, the UN got involved, and it began to grow. But then in about the year 2008, Legacies of War, which is the group that I now chair, really began concentrating on advocacy work with the U.S. government, finding out where the streams of money were coming from, working with our congressional representatives in a very concentrated way, and also working with Lao American groups scattered throughout the country to have them become advocates with their own representatives and senators to do cleanup in Laos. And that's when it really started to pick up in terms of U.S. commitment. So in the past 6-7 years, the amounts of contributions from the U.S. have picked up considerably. And now Obama's announcement is the very first time that there's actually been a multi-year commitment.
And do you think then, just finally, that that announcement of more funding is likely to significantly speed up the process?
Yes, I think it will. For one reason, some of the funding is dedicated toward the new survey method, which allows the operators to really find and concentrate on the most contaminated land. So they're clearing a lot more bombs per hectare now as a result of that. And with increased funding for that, to be able to do that survey throughout the country and then concentrate the clearance efforts on those areas, I think it will speed up the destruction of the bombs considerably. And then hopefully, you know, if that's done in highly concentrated areas in terms of population, we'll see the numbers continue to fall.
Titus Beachy, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, in just 3 weeks, a peace deal between Colombia and the FARC rebel forces is due to be signed in Cartagena before the Colombian people vote on its final ratification in a referendum next month. But President Santos finds himself at odds with so-called elites over support for the historic accord.
A new study in the US suggests that extremism online may be far more prevalent amongst white nationalists and self-confessed Nazi sympathisers than amongst Muslim extremists such as Daesh.
letters gathered in London yesterday insisting that the British government stop delaying Britain's exit from the EU and invoke Article 50 now.
The United Kingdom is now the second biggest arms dealer in the world, though campaign groups have raised questions of the appropriateness of many of the contracts given the sale of arms to countries on the UK's own human rights watch list.
And a Scottish rambler is suing Donald Trump's golf estate in northeast Scotland over a breach of privacy. 3 weeks from today, a peace deal between Colombia and the FARC rebel forces is due to be signed in Cartagena before the Colombian people vote on its final ratification in a referendum next month. The peace accord has been widely touted as a historic moment for Colombia, ending a decades-long conflict which has left major scars on the country, with over a quarter of a million dead, 45,000 missing and around 6.9 million people displaced.
Despite the historic significance, however, and the widespread optimism over the impact of the peace deal, it seems that Colombian elites remain to be convinced. President Juan Manuel Santos said this week, quote, "I don't understand why my peers in the elite of which I am part, I'm a member of the poshest clubs in the capital, have allowed themselves to be misinformed on the advantages of peace," adding, "I'm sad to see that these people don't understand the importance of taking these steps to leave our children a more peaceful country."
When the peace deal is officially signed and ratified by the referendum in October, the rebel forces will have 180 days in which to disarm and reintegrate into Colombian society as a political party. President Santos has called the deal a, quote, "imperfect peace," but one that is preferable to 20 or 30 years at war.
With me on the line now from Bogota in Colombia is Professor Mark Chanik from the Centre for Latin American Studies. Thank you for speaking to us, Professor Chanik. Who exactly are these elites that President Santos is referring to?
It's not all elites, and it's a group of, and I think elites is the right word, but they're those that support the former president, Alvaro Uribe. Alvaro Uribe, of course, was the hardline president who worked for a military solution to the conflict here. And Santos went into a different direction and spent the last 4 years negotiating peace with the FARC, and he's come up with a very significant agreement. The people around Alvaro Uribe are adamantly opposed to this agreement, and they're doing everything they can to undermine it. Now, President Santos, he didn't have to do this, but he called for a plebiscite for the people to ratify this. And so the accords will take effect if the people ratified in a plebiscite, which will take place on October 2nd. And so there's a campaign. They went from the negotiating table to we're now in the midst of this very heated, polarized campaign where overwhelmingly the major political parties, much of the business class, clearly the young people, campesinos, workers, there's great support to vote yes, to vote C. But there's a very insistent group that is promoting no.
Is there a realistic chance then that those people promoting that position might have an impact on the general mood towards the peace deal?
Yes, they will have an impact. I don't think they will win. The polls show that yes is winning, but they are poisoning the atmosphere. They are basically filling the airwaves and the media outlets with ideas that this peace accord will not bring peace. It will only give impunity to the FARC and to war criminals.
What alternative are they proposing?
It's interesting. They're in a dilemma because people overwhelmingly want peace. And so what they say is, yes, we want peace, but not this accord. We want to renegotiate the accord. That's not realistic. I've been involved in observing, studying, participating in this process for a long time. Over 35 years, the government has attempted to negotiate with the FARC. This government of Juan Manuel Santos, over 4 years, negotiated a very realistic, hard-nosed agreement. And now the forces around former President Uribe are saying, we want to renegotiate it. That's not realistic. It will not be renegotiated. If people vote no, this will all collapse.
I assume that the general opinion is, as you say, the polls show that there is yes is very much in the lead. I assume that the general mood, though, is in agreement with President Santos when he says that this is an imperfect peace, but effectively just the only option.
Yes, that's correct. The accord is a document of 297 pages. It's widely available on the internet, and they're saying go read the accord. But the question, the plebiscite, is very simple. It says, do you support the final agreement to build a just and lasting peace? That's it. That's the question people have to answer. Do you support the final agreement to build a just and lasting peace? But what the opposition is saying beneath that, in those 297 pages, are all sorts of things that we don't agree with and that will do harm to the country. And so the question is, will the people go with the simple question, do we want peace? This opens the door. Will the construction of peace will be a long and difficult process, but this opens that door. Will people vote for that, or will they simply close the door right now?
Well, Mark Chanik, thank you so much for talking to us.
Okay, my pleasure.
In recent years, we've heard a great deal about the spread of Islamic extremism online, with the likes of Daesh using social media and the so-called dark web to spread propaganda and recruit to its cause. But a new study carried out by the George Washington University's Program on Extremism in Washington suggests that extremism online may be far more prevalent amongst white nationalists and self-confessed Nazi sympathisers than amongst Muslim extremists such as Daesh.
Amongst the researchers' findings was the observations that major white nationalist organisations had seen a 600% increase in online support, equating to around 22,000 Twitter followers in the past 4 years. Matthew Aitken has more.
The George Washington University's program on extremism found a number of recurring themes among social media postings of white nationalists, namely repeated references to the concept of white genocide and fears that the so-called white race faced an existential threat due to diversity in society. Perhaps the most significant finding of all, however, was that followers of white nationalist movements on social media are, quote, heavily invested in the campaign of Donald Trump for US president. So much so that 3 of the top 10 hashtags used by white nationalists were directly related to the Trump campaign. And in fact, the report even went as far as to say, quote, white nationalist users referenced Trump more than any other popular topic. Joining me on the line now from Vanderbilt University is Sophie Bjork-James, an analyst of white nationalist movements in the United States. Sophie, thank you for talking to us. Do the findings of this report surprise you at all?
The numbers are somewhat surprising in that an extra 22,000 followers on Twitter since 2012 is extreme, but it's part of a longer trend of increasing interest and membership within radical white supremacist movements, particularly in the United States.
Okay, and Donald Trump seems to have become a kind of figurehead for these people. Is that an image he sort of carefully and consciously cultivated, do you think?
I have a hard time speaking to Donald Trump's intentions and the campaign's intentions. The focus of my research has been on what people in the white nationalist movement are organizing around. So for them, they definitely see Trump as almost their last hope for achieving a national movement and achieving policy goals. Since I've been studying the white nationalist movement online, which has been over a decade, this is the first time that the movement has, from every edge of the movement, organized around supporting a political candidate. So for them, they definitely see Donald Trump as representing their interests.
Sophie Bjork-James, thank you very much.
As the Venezuelan opposition movement gears up for another round of protests tomorrow, this time the protests will focus on what organisers call a 10-minute protest, during which residents of Caracas are encouraged to stop wherever they are for 10 minutes. The rally is scheduled for noon Venezuela time, and as with the protests throughout the capital last week, demonstrators are calling for a recall referendum that would see President Nicolas Maduro removed from office.
Last week's demonstrations were widely tipped to have sparked violence or a major incident of some sort. Many within the government had feared a coup d'etat, but despite minor scuffles with police, the march passed relatively peacefully. The Maduro administration, however, seemed no less on edge in advance of tomorrow's planned protests. Indeed, the Bolivarian Intelligence Service of Venezuela have released statements arguing that opposition plans are still afoot for a coup.
The Intelligence Services Director Gustavo Gonzalez-Lopez said this week that the authorities had already obtained evidence that violence had been planned for tomorrow. The demonstrations take place against a backdrop of unpopularity for President Maduro, whose administration has been plagued by an ongoing economic crisis.
Attempts to trigger an election have been gathering steam for a while now, though through various petitions, though it is yet to reach the stage where an official date can be set.
Protesters
at Brexit! When do we want it? Now! When do we want it? Brexit!
When do we want it?
Now!
Vote delay!
Article 15 today!
I wasn't just describing that was protesters. I accidentally read the script a little too soon. Protesters outside the UK Parliament yesterday there calling for Prime Minister Theresa May to stop delaying and to trigger Article 50 immediately to begin Britain's exit from the European Union. The protesters gathered as part of the Invoke Article 50 Now campaign organised by the online alternative media site Spiked.
Spoonik's Jenny McCall was at the protest yesterday and joins us on the line now. Jenny, was there a genuine concern amongst those protesting that the UK government may actually try to block Brexit from happening?
Yeah, most definitely. A lot of them were really worried that the government will not invoke Article 50. And I think that is a genuine concern amongst the protesters yesterday. So they're really calling for the government to invoke it immediately, even though Theresa May has said she's going to do that next year. That did not matter to them. They want it done now. I think because Theresa May has gone back on the immigration points-based system, I think there's a real fear amongst the Leave camp that actually Brexit won't happen. I think they're definitely concerned.
And one of the protesters said during one of the speeches that the government was ignoring the will of the working class. Is that a consistent view with the protesters?
Yeah, very much so. Of all the people that were given speeches, they all said, you know, they were all working in working class environments and they all came from a working class background. And for them, this is a really important issue. They voted and they are the majority, as they said, and they want Brexit to happen. I think amongst that camp, they're very much concerned that then their voices are not being heard. Yet again, they've been ignored by the EU and now they're being ignored by the government. So I think there is that concern amongst them as well.
And just finally, did you get the idea that if Article 50 is not triggered soon, that these kinds of protests would continue and might happen more often?
Possibly, yeah. I think it will definitely get very heated. I mean, yesterday I met protesters from both sides of the camp. So I met protesters who are pro-EU and I met protesters who are anti-EU. And, you know, they were only protesting, you know, a few yards from each other. So, it's getting very heated. I mean, yesterday they were debating in Parliament about the petition to have a second referendum to discuss, you know, whether we should be actually leaving the EU. So this debate is ongoing and I think it's going to get a lot more heated.
Well, Jenny McCall, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Britain is now the second biggest arms dealer in the world, coming second only to the United States. Statistics published by the UK government's trade and investment body highlighted this position in the global rankings in July, with the body boasting that, quote, the UK is one of the world's most successful defence exporters, averaging second place in the global rankings on a rolling 10-year basis, making it Europe's leading defence exporter in the period.
A joint investigation between the Campaign Against Arms Trade and the Independent News site has now found that Britain has supplied over £10 billion of arms to 39 of the 51 regimes designated as unfree on the Freedom House Freedom in the World report, and around £7.9 billion worth of arms deals were with countries on the United Kingdom's own Human Rights Watch list, such as Saudi Arabia, Israel and Bahrain.
Joining us on the line is Andrew Smith from the Campaign Against Arms Trade. Andrew, thank you for joining us today. As your investigation highlights, several of the countries that the UK sells arms to are on the UK's own Human Rights Watch and many designated unfree by Freedom House. Though the UK does review all of its licences, and in many instances it revokes licences, so do you therefore believe that the UK government is not discriminate enough?
Absolutely nowhere near discriminate enough. We've seen the UK consistently arming some of the worst human rights abusers in the world. The fact that two-thirds of arms exports are going to the Middle East, with the largest buyer being Saudi Arabia, kind of says it all, really. The UK has consistently armed some of the most repressive regimes in the world, but also poured weapons into some of the most terrible war zones in the world as well. We always hear about how rigorous and robust UK arms export controls supposedly are, but every time we see it put into practice, it reveals that nothing could be further from the truth.
And do you believe that arms sales in themselves represent more than just a trade agreement?
Well, absolutely. Arms sales can never be apolitical. You're literally entrusting the buyer with the means to kill. And it's also sending a strong message of political support and political endorsement. The worrying thing is also when you see the side effects of it. So, for example, we found out earlier this year the UK had lobbied for Saudi Arabia to get onto the UN Human Rights Council. And I don't believe for one minute that that would have happened if Saudi wasn't the largest buyer of UK arms. Usually when arms sales are happening, you're also seeing kind of high-level state visits. And you're seeing governments turning a blind eye to human rights abuses and atrocities. How can we expect the UK to take a strong line against human rights abuses if they're profiting from them?
So there was Hilary Benn MP raised in the House of Commons yesterday the issues of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The government has stood by its previous statements that it doesn't believe that there is a human rights violation by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Are you saying the British government are in denial, or do they have solid information on which to make this claim?
Well, the basis of the claim Boris Johnson was making was coming from a report produced by the Saudi Arabian government itself. And the Saudi government is one that has shown time and again as a contempt for human rights. It doesn't take human rights seriously. It tortures and beats and violates its own population. Think what it will do to people in other countries. The whole point is that Saudi Arabia cannot be trusted to run free and fair elections. So how can it possibly be trusted to investigate itself for war crimes? When you look at all the external bodies, the United Nations has routinely condemned the Saudi bombardment of Yemen. They've put out at least 3 reports accusing the Saudi Air Force of violating international humanitarian law. We've seen the European Parliament doing the same. We've seen Oxfam, Amnesty International, Save the Children, the House of Commons International Development Committee. But only people who say that Saudi are following international humanitarian law are the Saudi Air Force and Boris Johnson.
Though the report this week doesn't just highlight Saudi Arabia, there are also numerous countries on the human rights priorities list, the UK's own human rights priorities list, who have received £7.9 billion worth of weapons deals, such as Israel and Bahrain. Now, do you think that the government should have legislation which actually forbids it from selling to countries that are on its own human rights watch list?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are countries which the UK has serious concerns about the state of human rights and democracy in these countries. By its own admission, these are unstable regimes. They're countries which are having large problems of upheaval. And I think there's a couple of different issues in there. The first is that when weapons are sold into these countries, you also have no idea what they're going to be used for, who's going to be using them. A good example of this is Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, where of course, Gaddafi was getting armed to the teeth by countries like the UK right up until about 2 months or so before he was getting bombed. So it's that kind of point whereby the lifespan of weapons is often far longer than the lifespan of governments that they're sold to. But also there's a point about relationships with other governments where the largest buyer of UK arms in the 70s would have been Iran. We also saw UK arms exports to Russia throughout the 90s and the early noughties. And of course, in these cases, those weapons are still there. And those weapons are still with the buyers. And it's that issue where you don't know what's going to be happening next. And it seems like in an unstable world, one of the worst things you can do is pump even more weapons into it.
Andrew Smith, thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you.
And finally, a Scottish rambler is suing Donald Trump's golf course near Aberdeen for breach of privacy. Rohan Beats has accused the staff of breaching the Data Protection Act by taking and retaining footage of her on their mobile phones. The resort apparently was not displaying appropriate signs warning that CCTV filming could be taking place.
The footage was used to prosecute Miss Beats under charges of public annoyance. Of course, Scotland has many laws allowing public access to open land, but Miss Beats and a friend were challenged by resort staff while out walking. The charges were levied against the rambler as she allegedly ducked behind a sand dune to relieve herself.
Well, maybe Donald Trump should install more public toilets. And then this whole situation could have been averted.
Indeed it could have.
I'm a solutions man, Carolyn. That is unfortunately all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.